Normally when you use a GPS, there's a very comforting certainty to the whole experience,
Oh,
right?
absolutely.
You type in your destination, this bright blue line pops up on the screen, and a calm, synthetic voice tells you exactly when to turn, which lane to be in.
Right, and exactly what time you're gonna get there.
Exactly. You're
Yeah.
firmly on the map. You know your exact place in the world.
Because it's a completely structured environment, it's
Yeah.
predictable, and I think more importantly, it offloads the burden of constant decision making.
Yeah.
You just follow the route, you know? You know exactly what is expected of you at every single mile marker.
But then, occasionally you hit a massive unexpected detour.
Right.
Like you drive just a little too far off the highway and that comforting blue line completely vanishes.
Just gone.
Gone. And the screen just shows your little car icon floating in this like gray, unmarked void. The map is gone. The compass is just spinning in circles. And suddenly you have absolutely no idea which way is north. You're entirely on your own.
Yeah, I mean, that is probably the most accurate visual description I've heard of the sheer disorientation of a major life transition.
Wow. Yeah.
You've literally just driven off the edge of your personal map, and that structured environment you relied on, the one that, told you where to be and what to value, it just completely vanishes overnight.
Well, welcome to this deep dive. Learner, if you are listening to this right now, whether you are, gearing up for a massive career shift, stepping into a brand new phase of life, or just sitting there feeling like your personal GPS is endlessly recalculating, you are in the exact right place.
You really are.
Today, we are decoding a stack of five highly practical blog posts from VCN, which is the Veterans Career Network.
And I should point out, while these sources are specifically written about the veteran experience, so focusing heavily on navigating the shift from high-stakes service like the military or first responders into civilian life, the frameworks they outline are profoundly universal.
Right. It's not just for veterans.
Exactly. You do not need to be a veteran to benefit from this. The principles, they apply to anyone stepping out of a rigid environment into just a total blank slate.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We are looking at a masterclass in treating a personal transition with the exact same operational rigor you would apply to a professional mission.
Spot on.
But we're going to do it without that crushing information overload that usually comes with self-help advice,
Yeah.
We're breaking this down into actionable, lean systems.
Right, because the overarching theme across all these sources is intentionality. We are not just going to run through a superficial checklist of what to do during a transition.
Yeah, checklists only go so far.
Exactly. We need to understand the underlying mechanics, like why our brains react the way they do when familiar structures are suddenly stripped away.
So what's actually happening in the brain there?
Well, when you lose an overarching structure, your brain perceives that vacuum as a threat, which triggers very specific psychological and physiological responses.
Which naturally brings us to the internal baseline. Because before we can figure out how to present ourselves to the civilian world, and long before we try to build a new map, we have to master the voice inside our own heads.
You really do.
You just cannot execute a brilliant career strategy if your mind is still operating in like full combat mode.
Yeah, the sources refer to this hurdle as quieting the inner critic. For people coming out of high-stakes environments, that inner critic is usually operating at maximum volume.
Just deafening.
Right. But the text makes a really crucial distinction here. This voice is not inherently bad.
Really?
Yeah, it's not an enemy you need to destroy. It actually speaks the language of high standards, vigilance, accountability. I mean, it is the exact same voice that kept people alive or kept their teams safe when the stakes were literally life and death.
Okay, so the problem isn't the voice itself. It's that this voice has absolutely no volume dial. It doesn't know how to calibrate to a new reality. The source material points out that this inner critic grades a slow, mundane civilian Tuesday the exact same way it grades a terrible, high-stakes day in the field.
Which is exhausting.
So exhausting.
Yeah.
Left unchecked, it will completely burn you out during a season of your life that is actually begging you to slow down, reflect, and gather your bearings.
And the proposed solution here is incredibly pragmatic. The goal isn't to silence this critic through, toxic positivity. And you certainly aren't trying to become a softer version of yourself. The goal is simply to change the critic's job description.
Oh, I love that. It's like having a high-end, incredibly expensive smoke detector that goes off when you are just making toast.
Yes, that's exactly it.
You don't want to throw the detector
away.
Right.
Yeah.
You still want to know if there's a real fire. You just need to recalibrate the sensitivity so you don't accidentally burn your own house down in a panic over a missed email.
Yeah.
You want to move it from sentry duty, where it is constantly scanning the horizon for immediate threats, to the role of a trusted advisor that only speaks when called upon.
Right. And to achieve that recalibration, the sources outline three concrete moves. The first one is to just name the voice.
Name it. Like what?
Give it a plain non-clinical name, like my inner sergeant.
Okay.
And what's fascinating here is the psychology behind this. By giving the voice a name, you are engaging in cognitive diffusion.
Cognitive diffusion. Okay, break that down for us.
So you create this microscopic amount of distance between yourself and the thought. You begin to realize you are not the anxious thought itself. You are the consciousness observing the thought. And in that tiny gap of distance, that's where you find the power of choice.
Wow. Okay, so once you establish that distance, move number two is to aggressively check the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because the inner critic loves absolute words, right?
Oh, it thrives on words like always or never.
Exactly. It loves to tell you that you always mess up interviews or you never get it right or you simply can't do this civilian thing.
Right.
When it throws those absolutes at you, you have to ask it for the specific receipts. The text notes that almost every single time, the actual specific evidence is way thinner than the overwhelming, heavy feeling the critic is pushing onto you.
Which naturally leads to the third move. You have to give that inner sergeant a new, highly specific and productive job.
Keep it busy.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of letting it tear down your entire transition plan, point it at one single concrete standard for the week. Let it enforce a morning workout routine or, a promise you made to take your spouse out to dinner.
Or even just making sure you have one difficult networking conversation you've been avoiding.
Right. You get one boundary to guard and you tell it to stand down on everything else.
Oh, look, learner, even with those tools, you're still going to have really hard, dark days. That's just a reality. But the advice for those specific days is brilliant in its simplicity.
Mm.
Do less thinking and do more moving.
Action is the absolute quickest way to prove that inner critic wrong.
Yes. You can't outthink an anxiety loop, but you can outwalk it.
For sure. But once you stop the inner critic from treating every minor inconvenience as a five-alarm fire, you're actually left with a bit of a vacuum.
What do you mean?
Well, you suddenly have to decide what actually matters, because once the military chain of command or the hospital shift schedule or the firehouse isn't handing you your daily itinerary, you experience what the text calls a slow drift.
The slow drift. Yeah, that sounds dangerous.
It is incredibly insidious. It happens when transition strips away that handed down structure and your priorities lose their fixed time slots.
So you just end up drifting through the day.
Basically.
Yeah.
You might wake up, check some emails, read a few news articles, apply for one job, do a load of laundry, and by 5 o'clock you feel completely exhausted.
But you haven't really done anything.
Exactly. You were busy all day, but your life hasn't actually moved forward a single inch. Everything just blurs together into this amorphous blob of being busy.
So to combat the slow drift, the sources introduce a framework called the four-box grid. And this is a working system where you decide, out loud, usually on a Sunday, which four specific things are going to get your real attention that week.
Right.
You literally draw four boxes. Top left box is one job search or career action. Top right box is one family and relationships priority. Bottom left is one health and body priority. And bottom right is one growth or learning priority. Four boxes. One single priority in each.
Just one.
Now wait, I have to push back on the source material here because I know exactly what you, the learner, are thinking right now. What does this mean for someone used to juggling 20 urgent tasks?
It sounds restrictive.
Yeah. If I'm a mid-level manager or trying to break into corporate America, my boss might email me on a Tuesday with a massive new project. I can't just tell them, sorry, that doesn't fit into my four boxes for the week. Limiting yourself to four priorities sounds like you're intentionally choosing to drop vital balls.
Yeah, that is the most common friction point with this system.
Right.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to look at how most people actually operate when they try to juggle 20 things.
Right. It's usually a mess.
It is. Most people wait until something breaks to think clearly about their week. They miss a deadline, they have a massive fight at home, or their health crashes. And then for about 48 hours, everything is an absolute emergency. They live in a perpetual 48-hour panic cycle.
Wow. Yeah.
The rest of the time, they are just reacting to whoever is yelling the loudest.
So they are completely mistaking reactivity for effectiveness.
Precisely. The four boxes do not mean you ignore the realities of your life or your job. You still answer your boss's emails. What this system protects isn't necessarily every minute of your time. It protects your core attention.
It's an anchor.
Exactly. Mm. When a midweek distraction pops up, like a random recruiter reaches out or a new hobby catches your eye, the grid acts as a filter. You ask yourself, does this new thing move one of the four boxes forward?
And if it doesn't?
If not, you note it and you let it go until next Sunday's planning session. You just don't let it derail the week.
That makes a lot of sense. And the sources point out something incredibly revealing about the bottom right box, the growth and learning priority.
Yeah, this part is fascinating.
If you sit down on Sunday and that specific box sits empty for 3 weeks in a row, the text argues you don't have a scheduling problem. You have a values problem. The grid acts as this unforgiving mirror, showing you what you are actually valuing with your time rather than what you claim to value.
And to keep that mirror clear, you have to pair the grid with a self-coaching habit. Basically, 30 minutes a week, typically Sunday evening or Monday morning, before the momentum of the week shapes you first.
Right.
And crucially, the sources insist you do not use a fancy app or a complicated digital tracker for this. A single physical sheet of paper.
Just four questions written on that piece of paper. One, did I actually do what I said I would do last week?
Simple yes or no.
Two, where did I spend energy that completely failed to move the mission forward? Three, what is the one hard thing I'm currently avoiding? And four, what is the smallest next step I can take on that hard thing this week?
The physical act of writing this out is so important, but you have to prepare yourself for the emotional reality of it. The first time you sit down in silence with that piece of paper, it is going to feel incredibly awkward.
Why is that?
Because you're not used to it. You might rush through it in 10 minutes and convince yourself you did the exercise wrong. You didn't. That awkwardness is just the unfamiliar sound of you actually stopping to listen to the reality of your own life rather than just reacting to it.
Well, the text notes that by week four of doing this, the magic starts to happen. You aren't just reacting to dropped balls anymore. You're catching things earlier. You begin to see the patterns of your own avoidance long before that 48-hour panic cycle ever starts.
Exactly.
But there is a very stark warning attached to this. This self-coaching habit is not therapy.
No, not at all.
If the answers coming up on that piece of paper are heavier than a week of clarity can hold, like if you are dealing with deep trauma or severe depression, you need to call a professional, a coach, a counselor, someone equipped to carry that specific weight.
It is a vital distinction. The four boxes are for operational maintenance and clarity, not deep psychological repair.
Right. So, okay, we've recalibrated the inner critic. We've structured the chaos of the week with our four boxes. We have our internal house locked down and in order.
So far, so good.
But what happens when you have to take that newfound internal stability out into a high-pressure external environment? Like the ultimate test walking into a high-stakes job interview.
This is where the transition often stalls. People prepare endlessly for the specific questions they might be asked. They memorize their resumes, but they completely ignore their own physiological state.
They forget about their bodies.
Yes. The source material argues a profound point here. The version of you that shows up to an interview is largely decided in the 2 hours beforehand.
The battle is actually won or lost before you even turn the doorknob. And to control those 2 hours, they suggest a 20-minute portable pre-interview routine. Oh. You can literally do this sitting in your car in the parking lot or tucked away in a corner of a coffee shop across the street.
Right.
I look at this routine like rebooting a frozen computer in safe mode. Yeah. And when you're panicked about an interview, your brain has 50 different anxiety apps running in the background, just eating up all your mental RAM.
Yeah, you can't think clearly.
Exactly. This 20-minute routine is a forced reboot. You are shutting down all the background noise so that when you walk into the room, your core operating system, your best self, is the only thing running.
And the mechanics of that reboot start with the physical body. Minutes 1 through 5, slow breathing. Specifically, 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, breathing exclusively through the nose.
So not just taking a few deep breaths.
No, this is not just some light relaxation technique. This is a physiological override. Breathing out longer than you breathe in, through the nose, manually activates the parasympathetic nervous system. It forcibly drops your heart rate, signals to your amygdala that you are not under physical threat. and physically stops your hands from shaking before you even attempt to speak.
That's incredible. Okay, so once the body is grounded, you move to the mind with story prep. You pick exactly 3 career moments, and you need to be able to tell the story of each one in under 2 minutes.
Under 2 minutes is key.
Right. You need one story about a hard decision you made, one about a team you led or collaborated with, and one about a failure or a learning moment. Keeping them under 2 minutes is crucial because in a high-stress environment, an interviewer's attention span just plummets. If you ramble for 5 minutes, you've lost them.
Then you close the loop on the company you're actually interviewing with. You handwrite, and the sources really emphasize handwriting here, 2 sentences. Sentence 1, what specific problem this role solves for the company? Sentence 2, why you specifically are useful for solving that problem.
Why does it have to be handwritten?
The neuroscience of handwriting here is key. The motor function required to form the letters forces your brain to slow down and synthesize the information. It effectively bypasses the working memory where all your panic is currently stored. It cements your purpose for being in that building.
And the final 5 minutes of the ritual are all about identity. You say a single sentence out loud to yourself in the car, a sentence that reminds you who you are when you are at your absolute best.
It grounds you in your core character, not just your resume skills.
The text explicitly states that the goal here is not to erase your nerves, right? The nerves are going to be there. Adrenaline is just a biological reality. The goal is simply to stop the nerves from running the show. You're putting the anxiety in the passenger seat instead of letting it drive.
Which leads to a profoundly empathetic point made in the sources. The true metric of success for this 20-minute parking lot routine isn't necessarily getting the job offer.
Wait, really?
Yeah. The market is wild, and sometimes you just aren't a fit. The true success is about cultivating a version of yourself that you will respect on the drive home. Even if you walk into that office and the interview is a total mismatch, if you held on to your composure, your identity, and your standards, the routine was a success.
Respecting yourself on the drive home, wow. It shifts the entire focus from external validation, like getting the job, to internal integrity.
It changes everything.
It really does. But okay, let's assume you're prepped. You get out of the car, you walk through the front door, or you log on to the video call, contact is made, the clock starts immediately. We are now in the spotlight, the first 90 seconds.
Yes. And the sources refer to this window not as an introduction, but as an audition. In those first 90 seconds, the interviewer is not actually processing the content of your words.
They aren't.
No, their brain is scanning you, deciding whether to listen to you at all. It's an evolutionary instinct. They are judging your posture, your pace, your eye contact, trying to determine if you are a competent equal or a nervous subordinate.
And for someone transitioning out of the military, or honestly, any highly specialized field, this 90-second window is a massive trap.
Huge trap.
The interviewer likely has absolutely zero shared context with your previous life. If you panic and bury them in military acronyms, unit numbers, and industry jargon in those first 90 seconds, you are creating massive cognitive friction.
Exactly.
You're going to spend the next hour just trying to translate what those letters mean, and you completely lose the chance to actually be an interesting human being.
But to navigate this, the framework breaks the initial contact down into 3 distinct beats. Beat 1, you trade the standard exhaustive resume recap for a single plain-spoken sentence about who you are now and what you do.
So not a laundry list of what you did 5 years ago in the desert.
No, who you are right now in the present tense.
Got it. Beat 2, you give them one specific detail to grab onto, not a vague corporate summary like, I'm a synergistic leader.
Nobody knows what that means.
Right. You give them one concrete story, one real metric, or one specific moment. It gives the interviewer's brain a solid anchor to hold onto in the conversation.
And beat 3, which is where almost everyone fails, you ask a real substantive question.
Oh, that's so true.
Most candidates spend so much mental energy planning what to say about themselves, they completely forget to engage the other person. Asking a real question in the first 90 seconds completely resets the power dynamic of the room. It shifts the environment from a one-way interrogation into a two-way peer-to-peer conversation. It engages the interviewer's ego and makes them active participants.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The content of those 3 beats is important, but the source material leans heavily into the physical delivery.
Yes, the delivery is crucial.
The advice is to intentionally speak slower and lower than feels natural. You are advised to talk in complete sentences that end on a definitive, downward-inflected period. Which made me wonder, why is the human instinct in these first 90 seconds to do the exact opposite? Why do we naturally speed up our speech and pitch our voices higher when we're nervous? And how does actively fighting that instinct buy you time?
This raises an important question about our neurobiology under stress. When we are under a spotlight, adrenaline floods the system. Our internal clock radically speeds up. We start talking faster because, evolutionarily speaking, our brain is screaming at us to get our point across and escape the danger zone as quickly as possible. Right. And at the same time, our vocal cords literally tighten and constrict with stress, which pitches our voice upward, often making statements sound like hesitant questions.
So we end up sounding like we are asking for permission just to be in the room?
Exactly. By consciously forcing your voice into a lower register and intentionally slowing your pace, you are manually signaling to the interviewer and, crucially, to your own nervous system that you are safe and in control of the environment.
That is so powerful.
Train operators don't rush. They speak in definitive periods. It projects immense subconscious authority.
And getting this 90-second window right earned you the next 30 minutes of deep, meaningful conversation. Getting it wrong by rushing, pitching your voice up into a squeak, or hiding behind a wall of acronyms means you spend those exact same 30 minutes just trying to climb out of a hole and back into the frame. You're fighting a deficit the entire time.
It is a totally comprehensive system. It traces the transition all the way from the deepest internal thoughts of the inner critic out through the architecture of your week, right down to the most external micro-expressions of eye contact and vocal pitch in a corporate boardroom.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner, listening right now? Let's trace the holistic journey we've just been on together. You are navigating the gray void off the edge of your personal map. To find your way, you first have to tame the inner sergeant, recalibrating its job from a panicked sentry to a trusted advisor.
Right.
Then, you lock down your weekly priorities into four simple boxes, backed by the rigorous honesty of a 30-minute Sunday self-coaching habit. When it's time to face the external world, you ground your nervous system in the parking lot with a 20-minute physical and mental reboot. And finally, you walk into the room and completely own those first 90 seconds with slow, deliberate, jargon-free execution.
Looking at the sheer intentionality required to pull all of this off, it reframes the entire concept of a life transition. We usually view a career pivot as a painful hurdle, right? Just a chaotic, stressful gap between two periods of comfortable stability.
Right. It's just something to survive so you can get back to normal. But as I was reviewing these frameworks, an idea hit me that builds on everything we've discussed. Look at the intense self-awareness, the deliberate emotional regulation, and the strategic communication required to actually execute these steps.
It's massive. If you can master your own psychology when the structure vanishes, if you can dictate your priorities on a blank sheet of paper when no one is watching, if you can regulate your autonomic nervous system on command in a parking lot and walk in to command a room in 90 seconds.
Yeah.
You aren't just surviving a transition.
No, you are forging an elite level of executive functioning. What if the process of transitioning itself isn't just a hurdle to get over? What if navigating this exact transition using these specific frameworks is actually a better, more rigorous leadership training crucible than the actual civilian jobs people are applying for?
I mean, the transition isn't a gap on your resume. If done intentionally, it is the most intensive leadership development program you will ever go through. You emerge on the other side far more capable than you were when you started.
I absolutely love that framing. So, learner, as you go out to face your week, remember that when your little car icon drives off the edge of the map and the GPS starts spinning in the gray void, you do not need to panic. You don't need to have a completely new, perfectly rendered map immediately. You just need a single sheet of paper, four empty boxes, and the willingness to choose your very next step on purpose. Grab that piece of paper, map out your four boxes, and start building your week. We will catch you on the next deep dive.